are you putting your
purse? I'm not doing anything at all. What do we have to do to get your business?
Well, it's very nice of you to ring up, thank you. No, we haven't forgotten you at all. This is a tiny, tiny little business. And when we need things, we do ring you, I can assure you. And it's not that you're losing any business at all. It's merely that Audiorama Limited is a very, very small business, established in May 1958. Very long time ago. And it caters for a small demand on the part of a very small public for the repair of obsolete and historic wireless equipment.
What we've got to do is offer some preferential terms to get your trade in. Obviously, if we can come down, organise it, find out where your net preferential buying prices are, as opposed to who you're buying from at the moment, we can...
No. All that is quite superfluous. You must forgive me, I'm needed by somebody else at the moment. Just forget about all that. It's all perfectly all right. Just leave it as it is.
Well, what we don't seem to recognise is the fact of the spend factor. We've got you with an account opened up since 1989. Our spend preferential treatment with you is minimal. We do need to get your spending levels up. Your purchasing is minimal. What we need to do is organise a meeting with our managing director, our area sales manager. If we could come down tomorrow and see you, sir, would that be...
No, I'm terribly sorry, it's not convenient. You must forgive me, I'm string on. I'm needed by somebody else.
Ist Mechthild da, bitte?
No.
Oh, hier spricht Maurice Seddon aus England. Mit wem spreche ich, bitte?
I don't speak German.
Oh, I'm sorry. Are you English or are you American?
I'm Canadian.
You're Canadian? Oh, how do you do? Well, my name is Captain Maurice Seddon. I'm what the English call a bloody foreigner. I'm half Hanoverian German hyphen French, and the other half is English. And I'm calling you from near London in England. You're a friend of Mechthild, are you?
Yes.
Do you know when she's coming in?
Later this evening.
Sorry?
Sometime later this evening.
Yes, I see. May I ask your name?
I prefer to, let you speak to her.
You see, I'm a very open person. I've told you who I am,
yeah,
but you obviously favour the modern creed of anonymity,
yeah,
which personally I detest, but there we are. Never mind. Anyway, give Mechthild my kind regards. Tell her I'll ring again later. Have you any suggestion as to what time might be a good idea to ring?
I think she told you that she'd call you.
Yes, but I just thought I would ring in case she had news, and also it would save her the expense of the call.
Yes.
I suppose you don't happen to know the answer to the question, do you?
No, I prefer not to tell you anything, actually.
Okay. Righto. So now, would you think if I ring... Now, the time now here is 7:10, so presumably with you it's 8:10, is that right?
That's right.
Uh-huh. Would you think in 1 hour would be good?
No, probably not.
Not? In 2 hours would be better?
Maybe, yeah.
Well, let's go a stage further. In 3 hours, would that be better still?
Oh, no, that would be too late.
Late. About 2 hours.
It'd be better if you didn't call.
Why is that?
Well, she told you that she'd call you.
Yes, I see. But you don't think she's got the information yet, do you?
Whatever information she has, she'd have to give it to you herself.
Yes. Okay. Thank you very much. Give her my kind regards. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Hello? Sikkerhetslivet i detail?
Yeah?
It's good?
Good afternoon. I'm William English, and you're listening to Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM and www.resonancefm.com on the net. This week's programme features bagpipes, so look away now. Why bagpipes? Well, many years ago, I took some photographs of Vivian Westwood in the shop known as Sex. And these are presently showing in the recently launched Summerhall Arts Centre in Edinburgh until the end of September. The exhibition is called Venus with Severed Leg. Just Google Venus with Severed Leg and Summerhall, all one word, and you should find it. So, we visited Edinburgh to attend the opening of the exhibition. This was the first time that I had visited Edinburgh since, well, many years ago when I was about 10 years old. On that occasion, my father had chosen to take the family to the Edinburgh Tattoo so that my Dutch mother could be acquainted with the customs and traditions of Great Britain, such as watching a group of soldiers dismantle and assemble a field gun in record time. My dad having been in the artillery, which is how he met my mother in the first place, whilst repelling the Hun from Holland. In those days, the pubs still closed at 10 in Edinburgh, that's 10 at night. So as soon as the tattoo had finished, Dad grabbed me by the hand and started to power walk down the hill from the castle. Not that it was called power walking then, more like running, determined to get to a pub, any pub, before closing time. My mother and brother trailing about 100 yards behind. Why he didn't just have a hip flask, I don't know, but perhaps he craved the company of others rather than drinking on the street with his family. My only other memory of that trip was a cafeteria, which had a conveyor belt behind the counter, along which travelled plates of fried food, all very sophisticated to a 10-year-old. So that was the last time in Edinburgh. This time, my partner and I checked into a travelodge on Waterloo Place at the end of Princes Street. At 3 a.m, our room was filled with a high-pitched, intermittent screeching sound. I assumed it was something in our room and tried flicking switches and turning things on and off, but the noise continued regardless. After about 5 minutes, we realised it was in fact the fire alarm and the whole hotel had been evacuated. We were the last to arrive on the pavement, where about 100 people were gathered in various states of undress as the fire brigade went in, accompanied by the intermittent high-pitched whining, apparently caused by a leaking boiler. After about 30 minutes, we were allowed back in. I'm still exchanging emails with Travelodge. The opening night at Summerhall, that's the arts centre, was overwhelmed by a private party for The List, a magazine. 1,500 partygoers were streaming in as we left. The exhibition, Venus with Severed Leg, was reviewed in The Scotsman this week. So, bagpipes. Well, I used to have a Moulton bicycle. David Lester chose to feature bicycles as one of his Kino Club presentations at the Clinker in Islington. He asked me to assist, and I arrived on the Moulton. Bring it in, he suggested, but I foolishly locked it to a cast iron railing instead, whilst inside the venue, watching vintage footage of early Moulton bicycles, accompanied by David's usual droll commentary, someone broke the railing outside and made off with my Moulton bike. One of those strange but true coincidental events that might convince you that everything is planned. I searched for a replacement Moulton bike, a grey space frame, 1989, and through the pages of the Moultoneer, a specialist newspaper sort of directed at Moulton owners, I contacted a lady who was selling hers and agreed to meet me in Henley-on-Thames. During the transaction, I discovered that this lady was a maestro of the Northumbrian bagpipes. After Edinburgh, I sought out bagpipe music for today's programme, and in HMV came across a significant section of music by one Catherine Tickell, Northumbrian bagpipe player. I mentioned this to Sandra, and we agreed that the name Tickell was familiar. It must be the lady who sold me the Moulton. I searched through my bicycle receipts and found the paperwork relating to the purchase of the bicycle. There, at the top of the handwritten receipt, was the lady's name and address. The Northumbrian bagpipe player who had sold me the Moulton in Henley-on-Thames, which had been stolen whilst I was watching a film about Moultons in a pub in Islington. Anne Borland Grimsby. same bagpipes, different woman. So, the tracks today are from Up South by Fred Morrison and Throats by David Watson. I would, of course, have included Rufus Harley, the great jazz bagpipe player, who I saw once at Ronnie Scott's when he accompanied Sonny Rollins, but the double CD hasn't yet arrived. So Rufus Harley will have to feature on a forthcoming programme. So the first track up is Up South by Fred Morrison.
Thank you. Someday they'll say Bukowski knew. Lay down for 3 or 4 days till you get your juices back, then get up, look around, and do it. That's my problem. I'm used to living with a woman. I try not to, but somehow I find myself with one. When I'm alone, I'm handling my own propositions. So I always, or usually, when I'm alone, I have periods where, you know, I feel a little weak or depressed or fuck it, the Wheaties aren't going down right. I just go to bed for 3 days and 4 nights, pull down all the shades and just go to bed, get up, shit, piss, drink a beer now and then, go back to bed. I come out of that completely re-enlightened for 2 or 3 months. I get power from that. I think someday, I'll say this psychotic guy knew something that, you know, in days ahead of medicine and how they figure these things out, everybody should go to bed now and then when they're down low and just give it up for 3 or 4 days. Then they'll come back good for a while. That we're so obsessed with it, we have to get up and do it, go back to sleep. In fact, there's a woman I'm living with now, gets around 12:30, 1 p.m. I say, I'm sleepy, I want to go to sleep. She says, what? You want to go to sleep? It's only 1 p.m. We're not even drinking, you know. There's nothing else to do but sleep. People are nailed to the processes. Up, down, do something. Get up, do something, go to sleep. Get up. They can't get out of that circle. You'll see. Someday they'll say, Bukowski knew. Lay down for 3 or 4 days so you get your juices back. Then get up, look around, and do it. But who the hell can do it because you need a dollar, you know? So I decided I'd rather starve, live on the edges of nowhere, than do anything at all, than become anything labeled. So for 50 years, I was a scarecrow unlabeled, and now I'm supposed to be a writer. Because in the last 10 years, what I wrote for a while has become translated into what? 12 languages, 13, I don't know. So the cancer's spreading all over Europe, and now I'm supposed to be famous everywhere but here in America.
Why is that?
Because the gods and decided to protect me from getting the ultra-fat head. They have decided to keep me clean and good so I can keep on working in all other areas. That's all. Besides that, Europe is always and will be at least 100 years ahead of America in culture, feeling, and knowledge. You know, there's the old saying that fame is the greatest bitch of all, or something like that. You know. But fame is a good test, too, because if you really have the power and the courage, and then they give you fame, if you can ride past that baby, you've got the final touch. And it's a damn good test.
Why do you live in L.A.? What do you see in this city?
Well, I was kind of, I was brought here at the age of 3, and the city kind of crawls into you and makes you a part of it, you know. And it's not so much that I see in the city, it's just you get familiar with a thing and it becomes something that you can understand. Probably if I'd hung around East Kansas City, I would like it too, you see. So it's just familiarity. I can know where to move around. I don't get lost too often here, often enough, but it's just knowing a thing. I don't brag on it or anything. Well, that's up to me, you know. And, was a totally Italian interviewer who was here a couple nights ago. That if I can't hack it in any area, I'm not a writer at all. I mean, if I were living in Beverly Hills with butlers and chauffeurs, I should still be able to write.
Mm-hmm.
No matter what it's about, if the writing's good, it's going to precisely stand out as good writing, no matter what the subject matter is. So I have no qualms about coming through. I have minor self-doubts, but no major qualms. I stick pretty much, it's the parts I leave out are what make it gel. The reality I leave out is mm-hmm. what makes the realities hook together.
Do you have trouble with people expecting you to live up to the expectations of the persona of Henry Chinaski?
That's their problem. I suppose at poetry readings I do give them a bit of the old madman bitch. You know? I'm still quite crazy, but it's only more sublime. But I give them a good show at the readings. Plus some poetry. So only at readings do I weaken a bit and give them the persona. In my private life, I am quite normal until I go mad. I go mad now and then. Right, darling?
Yes, dear.
But you're sort of a literary figure. You go to readings, or you have to give readings, and...
I don't have to give readings, but I don't give many readings. And as time goes on, I give less and less readings. And I don't like to give readings. I used to do it for the rent. Now I do it for a new set of gray steel radial belted tires, you see. What can you get for $1,000? So... it's weakness. You know, I take the 1,000, I read, it's over in an hour, but I don't like doing it. I don't write poems to stand up in front of people and read them. So, you don't think about it till, right on after the track, I have a drink and I sit down, it comes out. It's recorded, but you don't go around thinking, oh, let me sniff something out here, you know. Something will go good on a piece of paper. So it's subconscious.
But do you sit down to write a poem in a different way than when you sit down to write a story or work on your novel?
The only difference is mood. I can only write prose when I'm feeling good. I can write poetry when I'm feeling bad or good. And painting's the same way. You can paint when you're feeling good. I can paint when I'm feeling good or bad. I can write poetry when I'm feeling good or bad. I can only write prose when I'm feeling good. For me, that's the way it works.
You never think about why that would be?
Or no, I never analyze myself.
Hmm.
I'm one of those who's afraid to analyze.
Mm-hmm.
Afraid it might go away if I find out what it is. If I find out the seed, maybe the plant won't grow. Or maybe the goodies will go away, you know, everything will dry up. I mean, it's working without me knowing about it.
Mm-hmm.
Why tinker with a winning horse, you know?
Do you ever experiment, or do you ever want to change your voice, not write this character, your own character, I mean, you know, right,
oh, yeah,
from a woman's point of view?
No, not that, but I sometimes try to keep myself out of a poem and just work with lines of thoughts and processes. And I've gotten off a few that way that work. And that's a good exercise for me, because I'm so linked with what's occurring to me, and sometimes that could even get tiresome to myself. So now and then, about every seventh poem, I throw in one that has nothing to do. I'm not in it. It's just about things and lines and rhythms and just playing around. That feels good.
The track is your only hobby. Are you into any other sports? Baseball?
The track is not a hobby, my friend. The track is a Hemingway's bull ring. It's Manolete fighting a bull, facing death. It's rhythm. It's precision.
I understand that you see fame as a destructor, as a really terrible thing. In what way is fame destructive?
I don't think I've written too much about fame. But naturally, we see what happens to many famous people. They become pricks. They become inhuman. And they lose their humanity. And often, being famous, they lose their talent along with it. Their original drive, their originality. They lose everything but their money and their fame.
But how does one fight fame when one is the most read living American writer in translation in the world? I mean, you can't withdraw all your many, many words in all your many, many books.
Well,
so the damage has been done.
I think I don't fight it. I think I forget it because, going to the racetrack, and I think it has a lot to do with erasing my mind about who I am. And sometimes someone will come up to the track and say, "Are you Bukowski?" And I'll say, "What?" You know, I'm not thinking of that. I'm not walking around thinking, "I'm a writer, I'm a famous writer." I'm thinking, "I wonder if the six horse can come in, it can make it this race." You understand? So, no, I don't think they got to me yet. And they better hurry up.
Why?
Well, there aren't many years left. I'm 68, so I only have 20 more years.
Okay, that's quite a lot.
Yeah.
Did you go to the horse track today?
Yeah, I went.
Did you win?
Yeah, a little pocket money.
What's a little pocket money?
$257.
Okay.
I have two winning tickets in my wallet right now. But
do you have a system?
Yes.
Are you going to tell us about it?
I can't say a word.
Okay. You have said in another poem, "I lost my enthusiasm for the world at the age of 4.
Wait, say that again?
"I lost my enthusiasm for the world at the age of 4.
I think it was closer to the age of 1.
What happened then?
Actually, the age of 4, I think you really start putting it together and looking around. And I had some pretty terrible parents. And when you're that young, the parents are basically the whole world, you know. And that's all there is. So I felt pretty caged in, hopeless.
In what way were your parents terrible?
Well, my father was very German and strict, and there were a lot of beatings, physical. The razor strop. I think from the age of 4 on. That's all. It was rough.
Quote, Bukowski, "It seemed to me I have never met another person on earth as discouraging to my happiness as my father." Could you say something more about your father? What was he like? Except from being very German.
Well, he didn't allow what he thought were mistakes to be made. If I made any, what he thought was an error, I would get a beating. He was a very frustrated man. He wanted to be rich. He was very ambitious and but he didn't know how to become rich. He had no talent. He had no special flair. And I think he was just a little insane in that manner, over ambition. And He took it out on me because the world didn't quite accept him as he wanted to be.
Okay, here it comes. Charles Bukowski, the boozer, the womanizer, the laureate of American lowlife. That's some of the headlines when people are talking and writing about you. And sure, you have made no secret of a lifestyle that includes a lot of booze and women and violence. So now that dirty old man myth exists forever. Do you believe in that myth yourself?
Do I believe in what?
In that myth.
Well, it wasn't a myth at the time. There were women, there were parties, there were fights, there was violence. There was the police. I was in jail. I was out of jail. I was back in jail. I couldn't find a place to live. I was always being thrown out because of parties, cursing, broken glass. I actually ran out of places to live in one area.